Okay, I'm going to begin by reading a few poems from a book called 16 Sonnets. These are sonnets insofar as they're 14 lines long. They don't follow any strict rhyming pattern, and they don't follow any logical progression. The sonnet is the great form for logic. Traditionally, one should set up an idea, follow it through an argument, and reach a logical conclusion at the end of a sonnet. But being a simple fellow, I take one step at a time, I'm afraid. There's no reason for me to begin with these, other than the fact that the first one is a mourning poem, and that seems as good a place to start as any. A lot of my work is about mourning, as you'll see. The poem, as I say, is about mourning. It's a traditional form, the obad, of rising up and setting out into the world. As I walked out early into the order of things, the world was up before me. As I stepped out bravely, the very camber of the road turned me to its purpose. It was on a morning early I put design behind me. Hearers and deliverers to the hazard of the road. In all the anonymous places where the couch grass grows, watch over us and keep us to the temper of the road. This seems rather a jump, but I'm going to move on to night. We'll get some afternoon stuff in the middle part, won't we? It's a poem about night and the forest, both of which seem to me uncharted regions, opposed to culture, to light, and so forth. This poem makes use of the myth of the weaving that gets done during the day and unravelled at night. And since there's a kind of link in the word text between writing and weaving, text and texture, the weaving that's being done in this poem is the business of writing the poem. And it's the poem that gets unwoven by night and by the world and unpredictable things like that. What the day weaves, the night unravels. Here in the forest, all roads run wrong. What the weaver knows, the forest soon undoes. All roads lose themselves in the warp and woof. Somewhere in the poem, a stag should enter, but the stag is lost at a crossroads of sunbeams. What the poem weaves, the forest will unravel. This one is an imitation of an early Celtic spell. Something that happened in the Highlands and Islands until quite recently was that if you were doing any particular task, whether it was lighting the fire in the morning or picking flowers for a specific purpose, you chanted a prayer or a spell in order to make the thing work correctly. And this is variation and an extension of a spell that was used to pick the herb yarrow and to make it do various things. I will pick the smooth yarrow, that my voice may be gladder, that my words may be arrows, that my syllables be hard as tide-tossed pebbles. May I be an island in the sea. May blue sea asters cover me. May I leap upon the hillside. I will grasp the spear thistle, that no man shall wound me. May no rumour find me. I will weave the thistle down. I will be a wind-blown reed. My songs will lure the salmon. This is a song about the weather. Two good friends walk out in it. Several goats sit tight in it, their chins churning in unison. Tomorrow will no doubt be worse. Rain, hail, and a heavy mist over any firm resolve. There is a tiny pocket of air between the raindrop and the blade that is the condition of grace. Set a fence about the place. A tether for each goat. Though frost has us by the throat, this is a song about the weather. A poem that's an imitation of one by French poet Verlaine, which I must tell you about beforehand because people often think that it's an imitation of a song by Buddy Holly. As rain falls on the town, it is raining in my heart. On the red and the grey, the blue roofs of my heart, rain is steadily falling. All the gutters of my heart are choked with dead leaves. Through the golden eaves, raindrops slowly percolate. A shower of laughter splashes the old hoardings of my heart. The announcements of auctions, of square dances, wrestling bouts, the drenched images of holidays. This one is moves on from Verlaine to Robert Louis Stevenson. It's a curious cultural mixture, this one. It's kind of imitation, Robert Louis Stevenson, about hiding in the Highlands and so forth. Our boat touches the bank among a scent of bruised sedge. The startled heron rises, broken from his austerities. We are in a proud country, where stone chats to stone, where first pods crackle open, grey grouse and curlews in form. Keep well below the horizon, your flesh spare upon the bone. Trust to flintlock and sabre. Bed down among the heather. The wild fiddle music of the air, tuneless, will find you anywhere. This one is a piece of weather lore. And as you can see, I come from a part of the country where the weather is very predictable indeed. When cattle sniff the air and herd together in corners, rain will invariably follow. When bees fly short distances, dogs lie about the fireside, it is safe to forecast rain. When singing frogs croak, when toads come forth in numbers, it is a certain sign of rain. When swans fly against the wind, it is a sign of coming rain. When moles are more industrious, when worms appear on the surface, one must surely forecast rain. I hadn't realised before how much rain dominates this bloody book. Dismal. The next poem, we're safe from rain at least because we're in prison. This is a piece which is composed of some bits from a couple of letters, prison letters, by revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg. And she's describing the way that in prison the senses make do with whatever's around them. My eyes that were hungry dwelt gladly on these stones, the stimulus of varied tints, as if when parched with thirst I had been given a drink. On the monotonously grey sky there towered a huge cloud, like a smile, like a greeting, and I stretched out both hands towards such colours and forms. I shall send you a line, farewell, till we meet in my new prison. The sky and clouds come with me. I shall not take leave of them. I'll read just one more from this collection. This is an envoi, which is kind of poem where the poet addresses his own song or his own poem and tells it to go out into the world and do various things. Go, my new song, sit on the topmost branch, make loud the hedgerow. Sing the notes of the row, each with its complement of dew-drenched silence. Address yourself to air, to the ringing spaces. Insinuate yourself between the green hills and the sky, between the moist and the dry. Go, be as regular as the hour allows. Be not too careful, but take care. Well, breathe for a moment while I decide what to do next. I'll read you this little prose poem, which comes from a somewhat earlier phase of my work. It's a phase when I was producing a lot of phoned poetry. And this is a kind of phoned prose poem. All the materials of the thing were taken from a manual of photography. how to go out and take pictures of reptiles and so on, as you'll see. My only intervention has been to select the sentences and to place them in a kind of order. It's called Photography in the Open Air. A hand camera should habitually be carried on walks in the country, for it is impossible to say what will turn up next. The necessity for silent movement is obvious, but there is an equal advantage to be derived from the wearing of dull clothes and the power of remaining motionless. Since in stalking, the camera is brought as near as possible to the object or the place it is to occupy, it may be necessary in certain cases to disguise the camera or the operator or both. What seems requisite is an eye which is sensitive to small distinctions of form and colour, which can distinguish a bird's nest from the hedge where it is lodged. A power of observation confined to material fact without the disturbing influence of ethics. When the wind ruffles the heather, one pair of eyes may detect a movement which is not due to the wind. An attempt should be made to obtain apparatus of such a simple character that the hands can be trained to manipulate it automatically while the eyes are employed elsewhere. The writer is unfortunately unable to enter on the vexed question of lenses with any degree of authority. It should, however, be remembered that the intelligence behind the lens has a greater effect on the finished result than the lens itself. Mice of all kinds are excellent subjects for the camera. They must be taken life-size if a picture is to be of any value, for when the image is a minute one, there is a risk of losing the delicate shadows on the fur, which contrast so well with the brilliant eyes. If we propose to analyse animal movement, to study the various positions of quill feathers in the flight of a bird, instant exposures are essential, but the resulting pictures will not represent what we see with our eyes. The breathing of reptiles in times of distress or agitation is of a most erratic character. The writer has observed, in the case of a toad, two short gasps, a long gasp, then a pause of varying duration, after which the first movement is repeated. This pause is obviously what the photographer should wait for. The lizard, sunning himself on the stone, strikes delightful attitudes, but seldom maintains them for long enough to have them perpetuated. The whole life of newts seems dominated by the spirit of unrest. The ability to take a snapshot while riding a bicycle is most useful to the naturalist. The simplest method is to suspend a camera around the neck and keep one hand free to work the shutter. It is in the recording of what does not endure, of fleeting impressions and momentary gestures, that the future of photography assuredly lies. I'll go back, I think, to something I've written again, I'm afraid. It's another poem about the forest. Again, it's a kind of prose poem. And I think the title is self-explanatory. It's called 24 Sentences About the Forest. In the beginning was the forest, and the forest stretched everywhere, unbroken and single. When men let light into the forest, darkness hid in their hearts. If we wish to investigate the forest in all its depth and ramifications, we must first subtract all those qualities such as quiet, autonomy, or peace we have attributed to it. It is not the forest we eventually discover, but our own strategies of evasion. Woods, groves, and copses are deciduous, but the forest is evergreen. All the verbs of the forest are intransitive. Morning in the forest, an immense dew settles on compacted silence. There is a propriety which governs the intervals between trees. On warm, bright days, the lilting cries of siskins precede us through the forest, holding out the promise of a song which is constantly deferred. The deer learn camouflage from shade, ingenuousness from the glade. The streams of the forest taste of clarity and are descended from purity. The pools of the forest are gatherings of dew. The indifference of the forest is more terrible than the wrath of the sea. On the outer edges of silence, wildflowers and rhetoric flourish. The wind and the pine exchange fragrance for music. Only those who have come to the end of patience catch a glimpse of the red start. When you walk in the forest, do you bring nothing with you but your own contingency? Or do you carry a gun? Many common words are darker than forests. The complement of blue is green, of an infinite blue, an absolute green. Saints and brigands make the forest their home. To the congregation of shadows is given the stale wafer
of light. The function of trees in a forest is to delay our passage from one part of the forest to another. All we have forgotten about the forest steals back into the forest and watches us with shining eyes. When the axe falls silent, stillness settles into calm. Just give you a breather from these longer things and read one or two short pieces. You'll have to never listen fairly carefully because these are only one word poems. This is a form that was invented by Scottish poet called Ian Hamilton Finlay. And he defined a one-word poem as being a poem consisting of one word with a title of any length. Some one-word poems. An affinity of eye and petal. Iris. A sampler of simple stitches. Summer. A palette of watercolors. Horizon. An aromatic seasoning. Time. A rudimentary bud, eye. Neat Norwegian horizon, spruce. Sad Scotch horizon, pine. Legend for a garden pond. Reflections. A night-scented water lily. Moon. Some of those puns are so bad, I feel I must apologise. These are, again, fairly short poems. From a little book called Pauses and Digressions, which, although the poems are fairly straightforward, was in fact something of an experiment in that my wife, who's an illustrator, drew four little drawings and I wrote poems to illustrate the drawings, which is right, we usually work the other way around. I don't think it's all that necessary for you to see the drawings, you can look at them afterwards, but this one is a kind of a leafy lane covered in trees. At the end of the lane, beyond this cool depth of shadow, might lie a meadow where in sullen light we both might sleep, and in time awake, languid, dusted with a stupor of pollen, to take again our late way home through this recess of song. The second one's got a drawing of a little wooden bridge. And then we find perhaps a bridge of split logs, a place where we can stop and lean and bring before the mind what is or has been. There are such places, contrived for whoever does not expect them, moments of rough and ready carpentry flung across declivities. This one is a drawing of a garden lake or pool. It is afternoon. That extended, deliquescent pause, while the little tune of the ripples plays about your ankles. That essential hour when things exert their legitimate power and candor drops like a ripe fruit into your desultory heart. And the last one is a picture of a little archway leading out of a garden. Call it a garden. Wall it around with stone and stucco. And wander in it, saunter in it, careless, confident. Lay out borders. Let good talk drift among the fluted orders. And when the talk is gone, let a simple arch lead out and on. Okay, I'll just read one more fairly longish poem. And then we can all get back to eating and drinking and gabbing. I always feel it's right to end these things with a short prayer. This is a thing called a collect. I thought until recently it was called a collect. In fact, it's called a collect. Told by my Anglican friends. This is a form of prayer which one finds in the Book of Common Prayer. It's a kind of petition. It's asking for this or that. I suppose somebody might inquire to whom this particular prayer is addressed, and I can only say that you should each in your own mind address it to whatever gods you own. It's a prayer, as you'll see, for the golden age, for the age when the lion will lie down with the lamb, and various other early Blakean and biblical things will happen. A collect. Let the heart find water brooks. Let the seeds of gold be broadcast. Let the standing grain know the slanting rain. Let horizons unfold behind the eyes. Let lark notes fall among the raindrops. Let the recesses of the forest be articulate. Let the flag wave above the waters. Let the blue boat be unmoored. Let the aspen lean into intelligible space. Let the clearing be prepared for grace. Let the clematis test the wall. Let siskins tear the catkin. Let stars shine above the orchard. Let the geometers measure their own length. Let the fields be displayed and the hills be evident. Let conversation flourish beneath lime blossom. Let the bread be twice proven. Let all the statutes be songs. Let bindweed wind and woodbine twine. Let shade be provided by the vine. Let the window open onto fragrance. Let the breeze roar against the briar. Let the robin be sober and the wren inebriate. Let all the fountains be replenished. Let the moon rise unscathed from the hawthorn. Let the margin be justified. Let the lawn be embroidered. Let blight and gall be blasted. Let glance coincide with glance. Let willow and alder dance. Let the little hours be observed. Let arpeggios hang in the sunbeam. Let silence settle on silence. Let the ruins of splendor be restored. Let erosion contribute to consolidation. Let laughter echo in the secret garden. Let rivers break through the scarp. Let our mouths be stuffed with gratitude. Let the rim of the mountain ring. Let the caryatid sing. Let the latch be lifted. Let the daisy enjoy the status of the rose. Let light caress all surfaces. Let the colours lie down in harmony. Let your time be variegated and your iris single. Let stagnant pools be clarified. Let the great music come again. Let the convolvulus write its name. Let grace notes buzz above the drone. Let russets glow against the chiseled stone. Let rain refresh the upland grass. Let the seed fiddle scratch a jig. Let islands drag at their anchors. Let the lake run with crimson fire. Let light escape from the turning page. Let the eyes of deer be healed. Let rocks secrete honey. Let peace blossom in a thousand gardens. Let archipelagos break upon the sight. Let morning disperse the violence of night. Okay, thank you.